rope, to dripping black eye makeup and stalking Oasis. Later, her hobby was bulimia, while I became fixated on self-help books. We both pulled through. She's found a black cab and some silence. What's with the mysterious phone message? I need some legal advice. Are you in trouble? No, I'm calling for a friend. Says Jocelyn, choosing her words carefully. Because if this was about you, Megs, I would be obliged to warn you not to make any admissions or confessions of guilt to me, because I cannot mislead a court. At the same time, I have a duty to keep whatever you tell me a secret. Oh, my God, I haven't killed anyone. She laughs, and I realize that she's joking. I have a hypothetical situation for you.
Hypothetical?
Yes. This was a bad idea. I should hang up. Can a court order a woman to have a paternity test on her new baby?
That depends on the circumstances, says Jocelyn.
What if she's happily married?
Is her husband demanding the test?
No.
Who then?
A third party.
Someone who thinks he might be the father?
Yes.
Fuck, Megs, what have you done?
Nothing. This isn't about me. Why am I still talking?
Jocelyn begins thinking out loud. I practice commercial law, so I'm not an expert in this area. Most paternity suits are filed to establish financial or moral responsibility. The mother wants money or a father wants visitation rights. If both husband and wife agree they're the parents, I doubt whether any court would order a test.
What if the husband doesn't know there's a question mark over the paternity?
He would have to be told.
Even if it puts the marriage in jeopardy?
The wife put the marriage in jeopardy the moment she slept with someone else.
What if she knows the baby is her husband's?
So you're saying this third party is making a completely baseless accusation?
Yes.
There was no affair.
I hesitate.
No. Why would he do that?
I don't know. Spite? Jealousy? Cruelty?
Are you being blackmailed?
This is not about me.
Right, of course. Well, my advice to your friend would be to come clean and tell her husband.
There's no other way. No restraining orders or letters.
Not really. I can hear Jocelyn breathing down the phone.
Are you all right, Megs?
I'm fine. Forget I called.
I hang up and take a deep breath, biting my bottom lip to stop myself from screaming. I am trapped. My past mistake is growing inside me, ticking like a time bomb that will go off unless I can stop Simon. It doesn't help that Jack is being so nice to me. He bought me flowers on Friday, arum lilies, which are my favorite, and he stayed home all weekend. On Monday morning, I wrote a blog piece. Reflections. I had an ordinary Sunday. I don't mean ordinary in terms of boring, but it was normal. I woke to the sound of two little people talking and giggling, having crawled into each other's beds to read books. They played happily for almost an hour, letting me doze next to Hail Caesar. Sunday morning means BBC Radio 2, plunger coffee, bacon and eggs, and the newspapers, of course. This was followed by swimming lessons, which I prefer to call controlled not drowning, then lunch at the pub, before a long walk along the river, a bath, a cuddle, and a DVD. Frozen. Again. Sunday is curry night, and the house still reeks of chicken korma, no matter how many windows I open. Caesar drank half a bottle of wine. I fell asleep in front of a BBC costume drama. And at midnight I was ironing school clothes because I forgot to do it earlier. It was an ordinary Sunday, except that Caesar said he loved me more than once. A more mistrustful wife might have been suspicious that he doth protest too much, but I'm not the skeptical type. Men are so funny when it comes to understanding women. Caesar thinks my dream scenario for romance is a 5-star hotel, a massage, champagne, a great dinner, fantastic sex, and falling asleep after an hour of him telling me how wonderful I am. In truth, I would settle for a Sunday like yesterday. A sleep-in, a cooked breakfast, a day with the kids, clumsy sex, and loads of voluntary cuddles and compliments. Life doesn't get much better than that.
Agatha. At Euston, I walk across the Cavernous Station concourse and wait in line to buy a ticket to Leeds. I'm wearing my best maternity dress, black mid-heels, and a patent leather handbag over my shoulder.
I make a point of messing up my request. The tickets are reprinted. I want people to see me. I want them to remember. My train is on time. Pulling my suitcase along the platform, I ask a porter to help me lift it up the stairs and store it in the luggage bay. I find my seat. A businessman is sitting next to me, tapping on his laptop. I apologize for taking up so much room, using the royal "we," pointing to my pregnancy.
When do you do?
Any day now, that's why I'm going home.
Home?
Leeds. I notice his wedding ring. Do you have children?
2 girls, 6 and 4.
You're a lucky man.
Yes, I am.
He's looking for my wedding ring. Not seeing one, he won't ask. When the conductor comes along to check on my ticket, I make a fuss about looking for it, growing anxious and apologetic.
Take your time, he says.
I can come back. I search my handbag and the pockets of my coat, sighing in relief when I find the ticket. The businessman relaxes. The conductor makes light of the delay. Both will commit me to memory. The train rattles through the Midlands into the north of England, past ploughed fields and pastures dotted with wheels of hay covered in plastic. Beads of melting sleet run slantwise across the fogged windows. My stomach rumbles. I should have bought something to eat before I left Euston. Arriving in Leeds, I drag my suitcase to the cab rank and give the driver an address in Holbeck. He takes New Station Street, Wellington and Whitehall Road, skirting warehouses and railway yards that look abandoned in the gloom. The cab drops me outside Ingram Road Primary School, where lights burn brightly from within. The windows are draped in Christmas decorations, and little heads on hunched shoulders face the front of the class. A bell sounds, and children stampede for the doors, filling the corridors with laughter and shouted goodbyes. I grew up 5 streets away from here. I walked to school every day from age 7 to 12, dodging cracks and playing hopscotch on the footpath. The intersection where Elijah died is a few streets ahead, but I take a different route because I don't want to be reminded of the accident. I quicken my pace, splashing through puddles, dragging my suitcase. In Colenso Grove, every red brick terrace looks identical, with matching satellite dishes bolted to the walls. The front doors have been painted a different colour, blue, red, yellow or green, which could be a sign of self-expression or suburban anarchy. Reaching my mother's house, I retrieve the spare key from beneath a loose brick at the side of the steps. Letting myself in, I throw open the windows and pull drop sheets from the furniture. The beds have been stripped of bedding, and the wardrobes are full of my mother's clothes. I have never lived in this house, and visited only once before. But my mother seems to inhabit every room. She has no photographs of my childhood displayed on the mantelpiece, or hanging on the walls. Nothing to show that I played a part. I look at my watch. The courier company told me 4 o'clock. It's after that now. I get changed into my work clothes and begin cleaning the house, dusting, polishing and mopping the floors. The truck pulls up just after 5 when the sky is winter dark. The bearded driver is on his last delivery. He carries in a large box containing the birth pool, inflation pump, pool liner, hose pipe, tap adapters, floor sheet, submersible water pump and thermometer. Am I having a baby or cutting up a body? The water birthing kit is rented because I didn't see the point of shelling out for a new one. I wonder how many babies have been delivered in the pool and how they disinfect it afterwards. The driver's gone back to his van. This time he brings my super-absorbent bedpads, sanitary towels, lip balm, lavender oil, flannels and raspberry leaf tea.
Do you need a hand putting up the pool? He says.
No, I'll be fine. He's looking around for signs of my husband. My mother will be home soon, I explain. She's at work. He taps his forehead in a casual salute and jogs to his truck. I sort through the paperwork that came with the delivery. There's a maternity certificate that must be signed by a registered midwife or GP, with a space for the patient's name and details of the birth. This is one of the gaps in my plan. I can forge a signature and registration number, but it won't survive a check of the records or a phone call. 2,000 babies are born in Britain every day. That's one every 40 seconds. Popping out, drawing breath, bawling. Surely records must occasionally get lost or misplaced. Parents forget. Infants die. Their births are never recorded. My baby will be overlooked. Time will hide him. Going to the back garden, I light the incinerator, piling on progressively bigger logs until the heat forces me back. I burn my prosthetic pregnancy, watching as the silicon bubbles and melts, sending up plumes of thick black smoke that make the night seem darker. Research is the key to good planning. I've gathered intelligence and studied my options until I'm confident that I can cover most contingencies, apart from the unforeseen or the unforeseeable. I may not succeed, but I will limit the risk. Whatever happens, I don't want to hurt Meg, but I reserve the right to use whatever means. I go to my mother's bedroom and open my suitcase. Inside, I have a set of men's overalls, work boots, and a baseball cap, along with several wigs that I've purchased over the past few months from eBay and a uniform shop. I pack these into a tartan pull-along trolley. Having checked everything twice, I go over the timetable, committing it to memory. Finally, I stand under the shower, washing away the soot and sweat and anxiety before stretching out on a bare mattress, wrapped in a blanket, waiting for sleep to steal my thoughts away. Megan. I recognize the woman on the doorstep, but it takes me a moment to place her. She's the estate agent who sold us the house. I've seen her since, driving around barns in a BMW convertible, wearing her big sunglasses and silk scarves. Handing me her business card, she gives me a practiced smile, all teeth, no gums, calling me Mrs. Shaughnessy. Perfume seems to be lifting off her skin. The smell of overripe apricots and lime. I look at the card. Rhea Bowden.
"I'm sorry to trouble you," she says. "I was in the neighborhood and thought I'd drop by."
Her hair is tousled in an expensive, undeniably sexy way, and brings to mind a former beauty queen, 10 years past her prime. Is that cruel? Probably.
"I'm checking to make sure you're completely happy with the house."
"Is this some sort of after-sales service?" She smiles again.
"That's right. I normally contact people on the anniversary they moved in. It helps keep the channels open."
"The channels? It makes good business sense. Property prices have been rising. You're probably not considering selling, but if you did want a valuation, I could give you one."
"We're not planning on selling."
"Good. So you're happy?"
"Yes."
"How is Jack? Your husband, I mean. I tried to call him earlier to say I'd be dropping by."
"He's at work."
"And is he also happy with the house?"
"We're both happy."
"Excellent." She hesitates and looks past me along the hallway, as though wanting to be invited inside. "Well, if you ever do contemplate selling, I hope you consider listing the property with me."
"Okay.
Right then.
Very good."
I watch her saunter down the path and wrestle with the stiff latch on the gate. Cursing, she looks at her fingernail and sucks her finger.
I wonder what that was about.
Maybe nothing, but Rhea Bowden is the sort of woman who makes my protective senses hum. In the same breath, I dismiss the notion, because I have no right to be suspicious of Jack. Not after what I've done. Screwing up the business card, I toss it in the rubbish and go back to packing my suitcase for the hospital. I have done it 3 times already, because I keep changing my mind. Agatha. I wake up shivering, cocooned in a single blanket. The central heating hasn't triggered, and I can see my breath when I exhale. Dressing quickly, putting on layers, I go downstairs to the kitchen and hold my hands above the spout of the kettle as it boils. There is nothing to eat in the cupboards, so I make myself a black tea with extra sugar and wrap my hands around the mug, soaking up the warmth. My body feels lighter now that I'm not wearing a prosthetic, but I miss how secure and worthwhile it made me feel, as though I had a purpose. Leaving the house, I raise the hood of my coat and walk to the nearest bus stop. 2 old women with wrinkled faces are waiting, complaining about the cold. The traffic gasps and stops at the roundabout, never confident. Across the road, I see a little boy holding his mother's hand, and begin to ache inside. Having caught the number 49 towards Bramley, I get off at Kirkstall Bridge Inn and walk across the River Aire and the railway line. A quarter mile further on, I take the steps down to the towpath alongside the leads to Bradford Canal. The creature has woken fully now, humming faintly, sensing where I'm going, telling me where to leave the path and when to stay hidden. Reaching a three-tier lock, I cross to the opposite side of the canal through open fields with bright green grass. I pass a man throwing a stick for his two dogs. The bigger dog always wins the race, but the smaller dog doesn't seem to mind. A farmer on a red tractor is pulling a plough, turning the earth in neat rows. When I reach a second lock, I am deep in the forest, which smells of damp and ancient secrets. The ruined farmhouse is almost completely hidden by vines, apart from the brick chimney, which is darkened by moss and lichen. I'm close now. I reach the clearing. The stone pyramids are visible in a carpet of dead leaves. The floral crowns are brittle and dry. I should have brought new flowers. I loosen my coat and crouch beside each cairn, putting my fingertips on the rocks, letting each baby know that I haven't forgotten her. Chloe, Lizzie, and Emily. I mourn all of them equally, the dead and the unborn, and the one I gave away. Lizzie was my second baby. I was 18 when I took her from outside a betting shop in Bradford. The father only went inside for a few minutes to place a bet on a horse running in the 3:30 at Doncaster. The horse was called Baby Lizzie, which he thought was a good sign, so he put £10 on the nose. I know these details from the news coverage, which condemned him in the days that followed. The columnists asked, "What sort of man leaves a baby outside a betting shop?" The same sort of parent who leaves a 5-year-old home alone or locked in a hot car, or who feeds their entire wage into fruit machines, or lets a baby lie in a filthy nappy while they're smoking crack or shooting up. People like that don't deserve to be parents, according to the Daily Mail. Lizzie was tiny, only a few weeks old, with dark hollows under her eyes, like she might have been born prematurely or not quite cooked, as my mother used to say. She had a small, pinched face, and reddish skin, and skinny little limbs like a chimpanzee. I loved Lizzie, but she didn't take to the baby formula. She wouldn't suck hard enough. I made bigger holes in the teats, but she swallowed too much and coughed it up again. At least she was quiet. She had the softest cry. I let her sleep in my bed. I lay with my cheek against her small head, feeling the soft fontanelles where the plates in her skull were still forming. I woke the third night, and she was burning up with fever. I sponged her down with a damp towel and gave her paracetamol, and prayed to Mary, the mother of Jesus, asking her what to do. The fever broke during the night. I fell asleep, exhausted. When I woke, the sun was streaming through the window, painting patterns on the rug. I felt Lizzie next to me. She was pale, peaceful, cold. I cried and rocked her in my arms and said I was sorry. It was my fault. I put Lizzie's body in a heavy cotton supermarket bag and caught the bus from Bradford to Leeds. I dug her grave with my bare hands because I'd forgotten to bring any tools. I collected the stones and made the small cairn. I reach out and touch it now, listening to the stillness of this sacred place, where water falls and grass grows and seasons pass and my children sleep. "My new baby comes soon," I whisper. "I'm going to try much harder this time." Megan. An email message pings into my inbox. I look at the subject line. A little boy. There are two photographs attached and a multimedia file. One image shows Agatha sitting up in bed holding her baby, looking exhausted but happy. The second shows a midwife cleaning and weighing the newborn, whose eyes are barely open. I click on the media file and Agatha appears on screen. She's sitting up in bed, breastfeeding.
"Hello, everyone. This is Rory. I would love to show you his face, but he's hungry right now. I'm exhausted, but so, so happy."
I type a reply.
Congratulations. He's beautiful. I want all the details. How was the labour? Did Hayden make it home? Call me when you get a chance.
Agatha.
I contemplate phoning Meg straight away, but it's too noisy to hear anything above the diarrheal labours of the coffee machine. Every table in the cafe is taken with students who are hunched over laptops or thumbing messages on their phones. I chose this place because of the free Wi-Fi and the anonymity it affords. So far I've sent emails and photographs to old school friends and former colleagues, some that I haven't seen in years, telling them my wonderful news. Those who live in London are being told that I've had the baby up north. Those who live up north are told that I gave birth in London. Few of them know each other or move in the same circles, which is why the deception can work. The only exception is Jules, in case she recognizes the photographs of Violet with the midwife. Return emails are popping into my inbox. Congratulations, compliments. There's one from Abigail at the supermarket and one from Claire, my old boss at the temp agency. I contemplate sending a message to Nicky, but he'll wonder how I managed to get pregnant after so many failures. I leave the cafe and walk through Albion Street Mall. Turning left on the hedgerow, I keep moving until I reach Leeds Central Library, a grand old building made of Yorkshire stone with arched windows and a marbled foyer. Stepping inside, I check the messages on my mobile. For the past 48 hours, I've kept it on silent, not wanting to be distracted. I look at the log of missed calls. Hayden arrived in London yesterday morning. I've pictured him hurrying through the airport, his duffel bag hanging off his shoulder. His parents were there to meet him. He insisted on driving straight to my flat, ringing the doorbell, wondering where I could be. I listened to his messages. "Where are you?" he asks. "I'm at the flat, but nobody's answering. Your friend upstairs says you've already gone to Leeds. I can catch a train. Call me." The second message is more strident. "Are you all right? We're getting worried. Mum and Dad are ringing the hospitals in Leeds, but I told them you were having a home birth. Please call me as soon as you get this message." The next one is more desperate. "I don't know what to do, Aggie. Mum is beside herself and wants to call the police. If I don't hear from you, I'll catch a train to Leeds so I'm nearby." It's nice to hear his voice, even if he's frantic and frustrated. I knew a baby would make the difference. He's in love with me now. He'll forgive me for this because he wants to be a father. Before I turn off the phone again, I send him a text saying that nobody has to call the police or worry about me. I've had the baby, a little boy called Rory, and I'm coming home soon. I'll explain everything when I see you. Right now, I need to rest. Please let me sleep. At midday, I catch a National Express coach from Leeds to Victoria Coach Station in London, paying cash for the ticket, and smiling at the CCTV camera above the driver's head. No longer pregnant, I'm pulling the tartan trolley and carrying a baby seat with a curved plastic handle that folds down flat. Draping a blanket over the baby seat, I rest it on the seat next to me, periodically lifting the cover to whisper soothing words.
"A boy or a girl?"
asks the woman sitting opposite me.
"A boy."
"Can I peek?" He's sleeping. "I promise not to wake him. I'd rather not," I say. She frowns and shrugs. At Victoria Coach Station, I catch a District Line train to Acton Town and book into a cheap hotel with a vacancy sign flashing in the window. The receptionist brushes cigarette ash from her lap and stands on tiptoes to peer over the scarred wooden counter. "Is there someone in there?" she asks, motioning to the covered baby carrier. "Yes," I smile. "Do I pay extra for him?" "Not unless he needs his own bed." "No, he'll be fine." She asks to see my driver's license. I tell her I don't have one. "What about a passport?" "No. I need proof of identity." "I'll pay cash." She hesitates and glances again at the baby seat. "Are you trying to hide from someone?"
"My boyfriend."
"Did he knock you around?"
"Once too often."
My room is on the first floor. I pass children's toys and bicycles in the corridor, as well as a sign reading, "No cooking allowed." I can smell it anyway. Cardamom, cinnamon, paprika and cloves.
Unlocking my door, I check out the window and fire escape. An information sheet says the front desk is unmanned from 7 p.m. until 6 a.m. Guests can use their room key to open the outside door. This means I can come and go without drawing attention to myself. I've been away from London for 2 nights, long enough to establish an alibi and set up half my story. Hayden and my friends think I've had a baby. They've seen the photographs and footage. In the past, when I've taken a baby, it's always been a spur-of-the-moment decision, which is why I failed. This time, I've faked a pregnancy and a birth. I cannot turn up without a baby. Either I succeed, or I die of shame. At 7 o'clock, I leave the hostel through the main door and head towards Gunnersbury Park, where I catch a minicab on the North Circular. The driver drops me at the promenade in Chiswick, on the north side of the Thames. Inhaling the icy air, I cross Barnes Bridge on the pedestrian walkway, beneath a half moon that shimmers on the water. Reaching Cleveland Gardens, I keep to the far side of the street until I see Meg's car parked in front of the house. I don't linger. Following a familiar path, I make my way to the railway tracks, scrambling over the collapsed fence and moving gingerly over the crushed granite and quartz, listening for trains. At the back of Meg and Jack's house, I find my small clearing and fallen tree. Climbing onto the trunk, I pull branches aside and look across the garden. The house is dark except for a light above the stove and another upstairs in Lucy's bedroom. Fear balloons in my chest. What if Meg has gone into labour? What if she's already given birth? A shadow moves behind the curtains. Someone is putting Lucy to bed, reading her a story or fetching a glass of water. It could be Meg or Jack. I scramble onto the capped brick wall and swing my legs over, lowering myself down the other side. Letting go, I drop into the garden and immediately crouch, trying not to create a silhouette. Looking towards the kitchen, I see a pot simmering on the cooktop. There are dishes in the sink, finger paintings on the fridge. Moving in a crab-like run, I stay close to the fence until I reach the corner of the house, where I brace my back against the wall. A dog barks. Another answers. I'm exposed here, overlooked by windows from the neighbouring house. If somebody were to look outside now, they would see me. I promised myself I wouldn't take risks like this. I would follow the plan and only improvise if something went wrong. Looking along the side of the house, I can see the sitting room, which is empty. A sleeping laptop blinks on the coffee table. It belongs to Meg. Would she take it to the hospital? I hear voices behind me, coming from the house next door. Someone turns on a light, throwing my shadow onto the wall. I duck and scramble to the fence, knocking over something heavy that topples in slow motion. I reach out, trying to catch it. Missing, the birdbath shatters against the stone edge of the flowerbed, exploding with a sharp crack that reverberates like a gunshot. A door slides open. The neighbours have stepped into the garden to investigate.
"It could have been a signal detonator," says a man. "They might be working on the line."
"At this time of night?" a woman replies. Crouching below the wall, I press my back against the damp bricks, trying to hide in the shadows. A window opens above my head. Meg's head appears. "What was it, Brian?" she calls.
"No idea," he replies.
Meg leans out further, looking straight at me. "I see the problem. The bird bath has fallen over." Brian peers over the adjoining wall. His fingers touch my hair.
"Must have been a stray cat. A big one. Do you need a hand cleaning it up?"
He swings his legs over the wall. I duck. His shoes narrowly miss my head. "Jack'll do it tomorrow," says Meg.
"It's no bother."
"Really, Brian, don't worry. Thanks anyway." Brian pauses for a moment. His trousered legs are dangling on either side of my head. One heel of his shoe touches my ear. His weight shifts. His legs swing away. He drops back into his own garden.
"When are you off to the hospital?" the woman asks.
"Early tomorrow," replies Meg.
"Good luck."
They go back inside. Meg closes the window and draws the curtains. My heart seems to have stopped. It starts again, with a rush of air into my lungs, and I retch dryly, cursing my stupidity. Recovering my breath, I retreat across the garden and squeeze my shoulders through the small door of the Wendy house, where I sit on a child-sized stool with my knees against my chest. I take out my mobile and call Meg's number. She appears in the kitchen, looking for her phone, answering.
Hello?
You sound puffed. Agatha?
Yes.
I was upstairs putting the kids to bed. I hope you didn't run.
I'm fine. Where are you? Why are you whispering?
The baby's asleep. I'm watching Meg through the French doors. She's leaning against the island bench, arching her back, feeling the weight of her pregnancy.
Congratulations, she says.
Thank you.
How is the new arrival?
Beautiful.
Is he feeding well?
Uh-huh. Her back is facing me as she flicks on the kettle and opens a new box of tea bags. Meg wants to know all the details. I describe going into labor and giving birth, remembering what Jules had told me about her experience with Violet.
I love the name Rory, she says. Did Hayden make it back in time?
No, he arrived at Heathrow this morning.
Shame. Is he coming to Leeds?
No, Mum has no room for him here, and I'll be back in London in a day or two. Steam curls from the spout of the kettle. She fills a mug with boiling water, jiggles a tea bag and adds milk. She carries her mug to the glass doors and looks into the garden. For a split second, I think she's seen me, but she's studying her own reflection.
You beat me by 2 days. I'm going into hospital tomorrow.
Are you nervous? I ask.
A little.
A train rattles past the end of the garden. I cover the handset, but it's too late.
Are you near a train line? She asks.
Yes.
It sounds like you're right outside.
No, I'm in Leeds. I see her yawn.
You look tired, I say.
She laughs.
Are you spying on me?
I mean, you sound tired.
Exhausted.
Go to bed and get some rest. Good luck tomorrow.
Megan. To my little boy. I've been awake since 4:30 a.m. You're not due for another few hours, but I thought I'd write you a letter and tell you what life has in store for you. I have worried about you constantly over the past 40 weeks, but I know from the scans that you're strong and healthy. A lot has happened in that time, and we've had our ups and downs, but I want you to know that you're joining a wonderful family. Your father is a man I love, admire, adore, and need. He is my rock, and he will be yours too. You have a wonderful sister who is going to save the world one day, and a brother who hates seeing pain or suffering. You have only one set of grandparents, but they're very active and will love you more than you will believe a person can be loved. Topping it all off, you have a very cool aunt called Grace, who will try to lead you astray, but that's okay, because life should be an adventure. Now, I should tell you something about me, the woman who has carried you around these past 9 months. Firstly, I'm not crafty, so if you're looking for a mum who can decorate cakes, make Halloween costumes, or cut sandwiches into exciting shapes, you're out of luck. I can't sing or dance, and I'm terrible at sport. No hand-eye. That's your father's domain. I'm also not very cool. I'm more the opposite of cool. I learned to play the oboe and was the goalie in my lacrosse team. I know a lot of mums write lists of things they want for their children or how they hope things will be, but I'm not one for lists. As you'll discover soon enough, I rely a lot on guesswork, but thankfully my guesses are pretty good. I give you these promises. I'm going to say some things I don't mean, raise my voice when I shouldn't, and say no when I should say yes. But I vow that when I make a mistake, I will apologize. I promise I will be there when you want and need me, and sometimes when you don't, but that's my job. More importantly, I promise I will love you unconditionally, forever and ever, even if you vote Tory, or support Man United, or forget to ring me on my birthday. Take care, my baby boy. I'll see you soon, okay? Love, Mum. P.S. If you scoot over a smidge and stop kicking me in the kidneys, I'll buy you a puppy. By 6 o'clock, I'm in the shower, washing my pregnant belly for the last time. Lucy, still in her pajamas, sits on the bed as I dress, asking me questions about the baby and whether it's going to hurt. My parents arrive at 7 o'clock, and Jack and I say our goodbyes, which involve kisses, hugs, more kisses and more hugs, until I remind everyone that I'm having a baby, not emigrating to Australia. Jack drives me to the hospital. I keep going over things in my head, thinking I should have made a list. 2 kids? Check. House? Check. Meals? Check. We should have updated our wills, I say, suddenly remembering.
Now you're being morbid, he replies.
If something happens, don't worry, I'll remarry. That's not what I mean. He's laughing at me. I can't describe how I'm feeling. It's almost like a fake sense of calm. At the hospital, I fill out the various forms and get changed into surgical stockings and a gown with an opening at the back. Surely the most unflattering garment ever designed. As I'm wheeled along the corridor, Jack takes hold of my hand. He's dressed in blue scrubs and wearing a surgical mask and matching cotton hat. I can only see his eyes.
We're having another baby, he says, squeezing my fingers.
Uh-huh. Mr. Phillips is walking ahead of us, whistling happily. He's a chirpy morning person, which is better, I suppose, than having an OB who is cranky or caffeine-deprived. The theatre is bright and white and filled with technology. A whiteboard identifies each member of the surgical team. The anaesthetist asks me if I'd like him to put on some music. Jack suggests the Hokey Cokey and begins singing.
You put your right arm in, you put your right arm out, you put your right arm in and you shake it all about.
He's joking, I say. The anaesthetist laughs hesitantly and begins administering the drugs. You don't have to stay, I say to Jack.
I'm not going anywhere.
But you hate the sight of blood.
I've seen all my children born, and I'm not missing this one.
Agatha. Wearing a dark wig, dyed eyebrows and a shapeless overcoat, I cross the hospital foyer pulling my tartan trolley. Ahead of me, a large family carrying helium-filled balloons and flowers has summoned a lift. The doors open. I slip inside. A pink balloon bounces against my face. It's a girl, says the message. The maternity ward is on the 4th floor. I choose the 5th, administration. The family get off, and I ascend alone, knowing that most of the management staff will have finished for the day. The doors open, and I step out, not looking for CCTV cameras. Lights flicker above my head, triggered by sensors. A phone rings in an empty office. Turning left along the corridor, I find the ladies' toilet. Unzipping a pocket on the trolley, I pull out a yellow out-of-order sign, propping it on the carpeted floor. After checking that the cubicles are empty, I lock the door and begin to change. Maternity support workers wear dark blue trousers and navy shirts with white piping on the sleeves and collar. My trousers are extra long to hide 2-inch platform heels that will make me look taller and thinner. Leaning closer to the mirror, I pull open my upper eyelid and insert contact lenses that change the colour of irises from blue to brown. Next, I adjust my wig, letting the long fringe fall across my right eye, breaking up the symmetry of my face, which will make it harder for my features to be matched by facial recognition software. Unzipping a small makeup bag, I use black eyeliner pencil to thicken my brows and lip liner to slenderize my lips, before adding a beauty mark low on my left cheek. Finally, I put on a pair of dark, wide-rimmed glasses that cause me to squint slightly. Straightening up, I study myself in the mirror, amazed at how different I look. The old Agatha is gone. The creature is unimpressed.
This isn't going to work.
Yes, it will.
You should have stolen an identity card.
How?
You could have followed a nurse home and lifted her handbag.
I'm not a pickpocket.
This isn't going to work.
Yes, it will. The front pocket of the trolley contains a 6-inch knife in a leather scabbard. I debated leaving it behind, but I'm scared of what might happen if I run out of options. Strapping the knife to my ankle, I pull down the trouser cuffs, making sure it doesn't show. I am ready. I have done all I can to prepare, but I need some luck now.
Fortune favours the brave, they say. What about the desperate? Leaving the women's room, I follow the corridor to the stairwell and descend the echoing concrete steps. Emerging into a corridor opposite the maternity ward, I glance at my watch. Visiting hours are from 6 to 8. People are starting to leave, queuing for the lifts, making it easier for me to go unnoticed. A glass wall separates me from the maternity ward. The door must be unlocked from the reception desk inside. A lift arrives. A pregnant woman emerges. She's in a wheelchair being pushed by her husband. "Can I help you?" I ask. "I phoned ahead," the woman says, arching her back in pain. "They told me to come straight in." "Right, good. What's your name?"
"Sophie Bruin,"
her husband speaks. "My car is double parked. You sort that out, I'll look after Sophie." He disappears into the lift. I buzz reception. The nurse on duty is busy on the phone. She glances up, sees my uniform and automatically unlocks the door. I wheel Sophie into the waiting area. "You can wait here for your husband. I'll let them know you've arrived." I walk away, heading along the corridor, recalling the layout from my previous visit. There are 10 delivery rooms to my left and 2 postnatal wards to my right. 2 hours ago, I phoned the hospital and asked if Megan Shaughnessy could have visitors. Staff confirmed that she gave birth this morning and told me the name of Meg's ward. Following the signs, I turn a corner and step around a cleaner's trolley and stop outside a long room with a center aisle between beds. Curtains have been pulled around most of them, giving some semblance of privacy to the new mothers. One of the curtains is open. A woman is talking to her husband. Her baby is sleeping in a small crib beside the bed. I smile at them and move inside, walking between the partitioned beds. Almost immediately I hear Jack's voice. He's close to me, behind the next curtain, speaking to someone on the phone. "He's the most beautiful little boy you've ever seen. Right now he's sleeping. You'll get to meet him tomorrow." "No, he doesn't talk yet. He's only a baby." The cubicle next to them is unoccupied. I slip inside and pull the curtains closed, sealing myself off. Jack finishes the call, sending love and kisses.
"How are they?" Meg asks.
"Excited."
"I miss them."
"It hasn't even been a day. You should take advantage of this. Relax, sleep, read."
"And what are you going to do?" she asks.
"Celebrate."
"I underwent major surgery, gave you another son, and you're going to party."
"Absolutely."
Meg tries to scold him, but doesn't sound serious. A phone rings. Her sister Grace is on the line. Someone opens the curtain, surprising me. I jump, startled, my heart hammering. A man is looking for his wife. He apologizes. I pretend to be smoothing sheets on the bed. I close the curtains again and steady my breathing. Meg wants to get up and take a shower.
"You'll have to help me," she says to Jack.
The bed springs shift. She groans softly. The curtains move as she brushes past me. I wait a few moments and pull the fabric aside. Jack has his arm around Meg's waist as she shuffles in her socked feet towards the bathroom.
"Are you sure you can do this?" he asks.
"I'll be fine. There's a seat in the shower."
"Do you want me to come with you?"
"I don't think we're allowed to shower together."
"I'm willing if you are."
She smiles tiredly and kisses his cheek. Taking my chance, I push through the curtains to their bedside. For a moment, I think the crib might be empty, because the blanket and sheet are the same color. He's swaddled in a bundle, a tiny round face with hands tucked beneath his chin. I scoop him up and step outside, pulling the curtains closed and turning towards the corridor. Everything around me seems to have slowed down while I have accelerated. I am faster, cleverer, and more capable than any of these plodding people.
"Excuse me, what are you doing?" asks a voice.
Jack has come back for something.
"Doing?"
I ask, feeling my skin tighten across my face.
"That's our baby."
"Of course it is," I say, summoning a smile. "You must be Jack."
"Yes."
"And this little chap was born this morning. He's gorgeous. Where's your wife?"
"She's having a shower."
"Good. Well, your perfect little bundle is due to have a blood test. It won't take long." Jack looks towards the bathroom. "You're welcome to come with me,"
I say. Meg will need my help. Okay, I won't be long.
I turn and walk away from him, my stomach clenching and bowels turned to water. This is a one-time operation. I cannot turn back now. I pause as I reach the reception area, aware of the glass security door. The button is beneath the reception desk. The wheelchair I pushed earlier is empty. I tuck the baby inside and steer the chair towards the doors. The nurse at reception triggers the lock mechanism. The door slides open. I wave in thanks, pushing the chair into an empty lift. I press up. The doors close. I remember to breathe. Before stepping out on the fifth floor, I light up every button, sending the empty wheelchair to each floor. Tucking Rory under my arm like a bundle of clothing, I carry him along the corridor to the ladies' room, stepping over the out-of-order sign. Once inside, I lay him carefully in the sink and begin swapping the nurse's uniform and platform shoes for work boots and a pair of shapeless men's overalls with a stitched logo for a plumbing company. Removing my makeup, I quickly apply a different layer, using brown powder to create darker bags beneath my eyes and wrinkles across my forehead and at the edges of my mouth. My wig is replaced by a baseball cap with a graying ponytail sewn into the back. I tuck my real hair inside and pull the cap lower before putting a single silver stud in my left ear. The final touch is a smear of grease on the back of my hands and another on my neck. Glancing at myself in the mirror, I see an aging tradesman who didn't escape the 70s. Rory is still sleeping. He'll wake when he's hungry, but hopefully not yet. Most newborns sleep 16 hours a day, so the odds are on my side. Emptying the trolley completely, I gently place him inside, still swaddled snugly in the blanket. I've cut a hard piece of plastic to size, forming a partition that I jam halfway down the trolley, giving him room to breathe. On top, I put the nurse's uniform, wig, platform shoes and glasses. A clock is ticking inside my head. I'm taking too long. They'll raise the alarm and seal off the hospital. The creature inside me is yelling instructions.
Hurry.
Don't panic.
They're coming.
Not yet. Unfolding a black plastic rain cover, I hook it over the tartan trolley, concealing its colour. Now I'm ready. I open the door and glance down the corridor.
Have you managed to fix it?
Asks a voice. The woman cleaner is standing in a nearby doorway, clutching a waste paper bin in her circled arms. She's Polish, heavy set.
Blockage is clear,
I say in my gruffest voice, not making eye contact.
Don't forget your sign, she says.
I pick up the out-of-order triangle and carry it with me as I pull the trolley towards the main lifts, consciously keeping my feet wider apart and my head angled down. I thought of giving myself a limp when I practiced my mannish walk, but a disability draws attention. I can't risk using the foyer, and the internal stairways will have fire doors and possibly cameras. On my earlier visit, I discovered a goods lift at the eastern end of the building marked staff only. It leads to a loading dock on the ground floor. I press the button and watch it rise slowly from the basement. One. Two. Three. Four.
Come on, come on!
I'm about to step inside when the alarm explodes, making my heart somersault. The raucous bell clangs through the corridors and up the lift well. I have no choice but to go on, descending, counting down in the same slow rhythm. Four. Three. Two. One. I have no idea what's waiting. Armed police? Security guards? An angry father? The lift stops with a jolt. The doors slide open. I step into a darkened corridor with a concrete floor and pipes running along the ceiling. The alarm is still sounding, but the noise is muffled down here. Lights trigger above my head as I go, pulling the trolley behind me. My footsteps are too loud. The wheels of the trolley are too loud. Around the next corner, I see an exit sign above heavy fire doors with horizontal push handles. I put my weight behind the door and shoulder it open, head down, bracing myself for what awaits. The alarm is louder outside.
Hold on, mates, says a voice.
A security guard in a high-vis jacket is standing in the loading bay, talking into a radio clipped to his shoulder.
He's mid-30s, Middle Eastern with a stubbled beard. He's holding up his hand, wanting me to wait. Grateful for the shadows, I ask him what's wrong. He doesn't answer. He's still on his radio. I catch a few words. Baby. Nurse. I take a pack of cigarettes from my breast pocket and pull one out with my teeth before knocking it on the back of my hand. Letting it hang from the corner of my lips, I pat my lower pockets and take out a lighter, striking the wheel with my thumb and closing my eyes against the smoke. I crouch and pretend to tie the laces of my work boots, unsheathing the knife and holding it against the inside of my forearm. The creature whispers, "Cut his throat and run." "No." "He won't be able to scream." "Not yet." Straightening again, I lean casually against a concrete pillar, keeping my right arm behind me. The knife is in my fist, the blade facing downwards. The guard turns back to me. The shadows are my friend.
"What are you doing here?"
"Block toilet on the fifth floor." "You're not hospital maintenance?"
"Private contractor. We work out of hours."
He looks at the tartan trolley.
"That's an interesting toolbox."
"Bad back," I reply.
He grabs the handle of the trolley, tipping it forward and rolling it back and forth as though feeling the weight.
"Did you see a nurse carrying a baby?"
"No."
"Why?"
He lets go of the trolley. The radio crackles to life. He answers. I wait. A bead of sweat rolls down my forehead and into the corner of one eye. Stinging. I try to blink it away. The guard gives me a final look and waves me away. Pulling the trolley across the loading bay, I climb the sloping vehicle ramp, holding the knife against my stomach. The street outside is crowded with pedestrians, diners, revelers and people heading home from work. I weave between them, moving further from the hospital.
"Run!"
"Act normally."
"They're right behind you."
"Don't turn around." A church bell rings. Someone shouts for a taxi. I step over a smudged chalk drawing on the pavement and pass a pub with etched glass windows. At the next corner, I pause and dare to look back at the lights of the hospital. Nothing has changed. I put the knife in my pocket and continue walking. A police car speeds past me, then another and another. Gloucester Road Station is ahead. I swipe my way through the ticket barrier and carry the trolley down the stairs. The platform is almost empty. A train has just gone. The next is due in 4 minutes. They are long minutes. I stare at the electronic notice board while people seem to move in slow motion around me, turning their heads, blinking and talking. I remember seeing a TV program about a neurological condition where the brain alters the perception of time so that events appear to either slow down or pass in a blur. That's what it feels like now, as though God has pulled the handbrake and the planet is decelerating. Slipping my hand beneath the rain cover, I unzip the trolley, work my fingers inside until I touch the blanket. I bend my wrist and reach further until I feel Rory's head. Warm. Soft. Sleeping. I make sure nothing has fallen on his face. He has enough air. The gust of hot wind signals an approaching train. The sound arrives and the carriages follow, braking, screeching, stopping. I take a seat, holding the trolley between my knees. The doors close and we begin moving. The train enters the tunnel, but suddenly shudders to a halt. The lights blink off and on. My heart does the same. A voice over the public address system.
"Due to an earlier signal failure at Manor House, eastbound Piccadilly line services are running approximately 11 minutes late. Transport for London apologises for any inconvenience."
The lights blink again, and the train jerks forward, slowly picking up speed, as though driven by noise rather than the live rail. At each stop, I watch the carriage fill and empty with ever-changing faces, races and mixtures. Poles, Germans, Pakistanis, Senegalese, Bangladeshi, Russian, Chinese, Welsh, Scottish, Irish, English. I don't often feel sentimental about London, but I love being another tile in this ethnic mosaic. At Piccadilly Circus,
A gaggle of teenage girls invades the carriage, shrieking with laughter and tottering on ridiculous shoes. One of them bumps into my trolley.
"Mind yourself," I say.
Her top lip curls. She pulls her face to her friends, making them laugh. Leaning forward, I press my ear to the top of the trolley, hearing a faint, muffled cry. Rory has woken, but the noise of the train will keep him hidden. At King's Cross Station, hundreds of people are riding the escalators and crisscrossing the concourse. I slip inside a baby changing room, locking the door and checking it twice. Unpacking the trolley, I take Rory into my arms and rock him gently, putting my cheek against his forehead and whispering that I love him. I lay him down on the changing table and he watches me get changed, swapping the overalls and baseball cap for my own clothes. I dispose of the disguise, dumping it beneath dirty nappies in the rubbish bin. Taking a scarf, I drape it over my right shoulder, gathering the ends and tying them together to form a sliding knot that I can tighten or loosen as required. I push the knot back to my shoulder and slip Rory into the sling, adjusting it so that his body is snug against mine, heart to heart. No more wigs or disguises. We are now mother and baby. I am Agatha, and this is my little boy, Rory. An Irish name. It means the Red King. Tomorrow I will take Rory home and show him to Hayden, and he will see what a perfect mother I am and what a perfect wife I can be. I have my family now.
Part 2. Megan.
Becoming conscious is like rising up from the depths of a dark well, swimming towards the light, my lungs empty, screaming for air. Suddenly, my body arches and my eyes fly open and I draw in a breath as though screaming in reverse. A stranger is bent over me with a hand on my chest. Not a nurse. She's wearing a police uniform, dark trousers and a long-sleeved blue shirt buttoned at her wrists. She says my name. Snippets of memory flash into my mind as though I'm watching a frenetically edited music video. I'm in hospital. I hear an alarm. People are shouting, running. I picture myself having a shower, sitting on a plastic chair under a stream of hot water. Jack helps me get dressed. Together we return to the bed. I see an empty crib. Where is the baby?
A nurse took him for a blood test.
What blood test?
She said it was routine.
Another nurse walks past us. Our baby was taken for a blood test, I say. When will he come back? She looks at me blankly. Who took him? I ask. The shoulders of her uniform rise and fall on either side of her head. Why did he need a blood test? Can you find out? Minutes pass. The matron arrives. She asks Jack what the nurse looked like. I grow anxious, agitated. Your baby wasn't scheduled for a blood test, says the matron.
But the nurse said,
Where is our baby? I ask, my voice rising in panic.
I'm sure there's an explanation. A mole dances on the matron's top lip.
What explanation?
Soon after that, I heard the alarm. People were running and trying not to shout. I wish I could remember more, but I can't hold on to the half-formed images and snatches of dialogue. I think I collapsed. I must have cried.
A doctor came. He had red hair and freckles on his forehead, and he slid a needle into my arm. The world grew dark, closing into a single white point. Until this last star went out. The policewoman is still next to my bed. She is young with fleshy cheeks that give the impression she's hiding bubblegum inside them.
Where's Jack?
Your husband isn't here. I want to see Jack.
I'm sure he'll be back soon.
I try to get up. The pain takes my breath away.
You're not supposed to move, she says. I want to go home. You've had surgery.
The policewoman goes to the door and talks to someone in the corridor. A nurse. They're whispering. The PC comes back to the bed.
What did you say to her?
I told her to get the doctor.
Who are you? My name is PC Hipwell. You can call me Annie. Are you hungry? No. Thirsty? I need to use the toilet.